imagine that the last workshop on the last day of the conference is very aptly named Focus. And I'm glad that I was. As you'll know undoubtedly, and I have also written short pieces in my time, not necessarily fiction, but I did learn how to make people look at what I want them to look at, so you don't want them to get distracted by extraneous verbiage, and only later did I realize that you could also hide things you didn't want them to look at by hiding them in extraneous verbiage and other things like that. Essentially, the way you hide something is by giving them something more interesting to look at, and give you a short instance of that while I read my example. What I'm going to tell you this morning is partly theory and partly content and technique. Technique is how you do the concepts that everybody has been telling you to use while you're writing. You know, in a word-by-word fashion. You know, it's okay to say, well, you disguise things by, you know, telling them to look somewhere else. Well, exactly how do you do that? Okay, I'll show you. Anyway, to start with, so how do you do that? People often come up to me and say, how do you do that? I said, well, I could tell you, but it would take a really long time. What we're thinking of here is how do you do this particular thing, focus the reader's attention? Well, the main thing is placement. You know, where do you put the thing that you want to spotlight, or conversely, the thing you want to hide? I should have brought my glasses so I could read my notes. The first place is the establishment of where we are. And or who's talking, or whose head we're in, whose point of view are we using. So you want to place your reader exactly where they're going. What we're doing here is following roughly the old five W's of journalism, which I had to look them up. Who, what, where, when, why. Okay, I often start with where rather than who, but who is pretty close to the beginning usually. Especially if you're moving with multiple points of view, you need to tell people who this is, who's looking, who's talking. And usually that comes about pretty soon. Some writers, especially when beginning, think, well, I have to set the scene. So they start, you know, with a long focus thing. You know, the lonely cabin stood in the woods with the howling wolves dimly heard in the background and so forth. Well, this is fine, but it would be better if you were inside the cabin listening to the howling wolves. So that's a, you know, real crude indication of focus. Pick where you want to start. Close up is usually good, but there are good long shot focusing. I had just been rereading Shogun because I'm writing what I think is the final volume of the Outlander series, and it's, of course, a big, huge book. But this one is attempting to tie up the ends of a great many people's lives, so to speak. Not necessarily the ends of their lives, the ends of what I'm going to tell you about them. Maybe. I mean, yeah, I keep telling people, oh, I think this is the last one. Well, like I said, I'm 72. I don't know how long I'm going to last. So, you know, I would like to end the series, you know, in style. So at least this book will be an ending. You know, if I die before something else occurs to me, well, then everybody will still be happy. That said, I usually work on more than one project at a time. And so I write different kinds of books, and people are saying, well, what are you going to write after book 10? I say, I should live so long. But yes, I have a new Lord John book called Black Chamber, which deals with his adventures with British intelligence. And the books about Jamie Fraser's parents, which of which Starz has already made the first season, so I had better hurry up and finish the first. I mean, I told them what happened in it, which is what they used to generate those. And I actually wrote two of the scripts for that show as well. So it is, in fact, based on my book. But the book won't be along for a little while. Who knows? Which is an apt note to start here. I'm not telling you which book this comes from. You'll have to wait and see. But I will read you the entire scene. It's not very long, but it shows what you do with the focus. First sentence, Minnie had always liked uncertainty, with liked italicized. Yeah, so this kind of places you in Minnie's head. It's about her, and She likes uncertainty. Okay, so those are the two things you should remember. This is Minnie. She likes uncertainty. And the use of the word uncertainty already makes you curious. I don't know, what kind of uncertainty? What is she uncertain about now? Why is she not liking this uncertainty? Because italicizing the liked emphasizes that right now she doesn't like it. Okay. Minnie had always liked uncertainty. Not knowing whether the books she'd rummaged out of an attic in Paris were trash or splendid treasure. Not knowing whether the next person to walk through the bookshop's door was a customer or a Jacobite spy. Not knowing what the babies she'd carried for months inside her would be like in her arms, let alone what they might grow up to be. All right, so did you notice my repetition of not knowing?
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing, not knowing, not knowing. Okay, so we're reiterating the uncertainty. And so you were looking at that, but with luck, your mind was also registering the backstory that I was giving you there. You know, she's led an exciting life, but she was associated with a bookstore in Paris and Jacobite spies, to wit, one James Fraser, etc. This is, that particular story is Fugitive Green, which you will find in a book called, well, you can buy it on, as a single on Amazon, but you can find it in a book called Seven Stones to Stand or Fall, which is a collection of novellas and all that. But anyway, that one is about Minnie and Hal and how they came to meet and so forth. Okay, so then the next one, and not knowing what her husband would do next, this is a separate paragraph. But using the same not knowing construction leads you carefully from one paragraph right into the next. This is where we're gonna change focus. Not knowing what her husband would do next, okay? We hear the word next, okay, what's next? we hope all of this is unconscious to the reader and they're just experiencing this without actually thinking it to themselves. Anyway, what her husband would do next. Domestic bliss was, of course, blissful, but living on a knife's edge now and then suited her. Now and then being, of course, the important bit. This indicates that what's going on possibly has something to do with her husband. It's not blissful. Okay, nobody wants to sit on a bloody knife edge, she said, not realizing that she'd spoken aloud until she heard a low Irish laugh behind her. Okay, do we want to know who's laughing in Irish? Yes, we probably do. So we've kept the focus now moving off of Minnie, at least temporarily. Because it's sharp or because it's boring? Well, it does stop you dancing. We still don't know who said this, but you know, obviously he knows her well. Will it stop you dancing? She glanced at Rafe O'Higgins, who had come up to the rail beside her. He wore a caped greatcoat of fine blue wool and kept a hand on his new hat to save it flying away. At a glance, he looked like a gentleman, which he most certainly was not. Can you smell the land? He sniffed deeply, then shook his head. Not yet, Darna. Captain says it'll be 3 days yet, maybe four. She stamped her foot with impatience, only a small stamp, but he laughed at her and lifted his face, inhaling deeply. Fish, he said. I smell fish and a whale. And what does this whale smell like, pray? She asked, diverted despite herself. And don't say fish. Oh, whales have a strange smell about them, he said, narrowing his eyes against the wind. You don't get close enough to smell it often, mind. But now and again, one will come up beside your wee boat when you're fishing in the Irish Sea and let out his breath in a mighty blast. It smells of hot and cold, rotten life, racks of seaweed, and thousands and millions of rancid little things that have thin shells like the nail of your smallest finger. They stick in the whale's teeth. What pass for teeth in a whale. And, he added practically, tons of seaweed and the odd fish. Your usual whale's not picky. You don't say. She'd engaged the O'Higgins brothers as much for their conversation as for their protection while traveling and their ability to ask questions in the sorts of places an English gentlewoman couldn't go, let alone a duchess. The usual whale, you say, are there unusual ones? She didn't bother asking how he might know the O'Higginses got around. Oh, well, he considered, there's your sperm whale, sure. A great huge fellow, and he eats great huge squid, or so I'm told, and given the stink of even a small squid that's been left out too long, I think the smell of the big fellow's breath must be one to knock you off your feet. I hope I live to smell one, if only for the experience. You've always been a great one for experience, Your Grace, he said, laughing. You should talk, she said, unoffended. Tell me again how you came to lose your finger. Which one? He lifted both hands as though in surrender to show a missing little finger on his left hand and a missing top joint on the ring finger of the right. That one, she said, pointing to his right hand. Ah, that. I had a sweet wee ring, see, gold with a blue stone in it, and a whore went to suck it off my finger, and I caught her at it, just in time. No, I don't believe that for a moment, she said gravely, that she was sucking your finger, I mean. Well, she was sucking a number of things, he said, lifting one shoulder. I dare say I lost track. Minnie herself had long since lost track of the number of stories he'd told regarding the loss of his digits, but he could always think of a new one. And he had, as usual, succeeded in distracting her mind, if only for a few precious moments, from the thoughts that weighed upon it. And this is where we actually find out what she's up to some extent, after I didn't pour all that out on you in the beginning. Even now, her hand was creeping under her cloak and into the slit in her petticoat to find her pocket and touch the letter inside. Adam seldom wrote a proper letter. Her second son had inherited, or possibly consciously imitated, though she didn't want to suspect him of that, his father's habit of seldom either addressing or signing letters, and using the minimum number of words to convey whatever was on his mind. But he'd addressed this one, "Dear Mother," and signed it as well, adding, "Your most obedient, humble, and loving son," which frightened her, as did the body of the letter, as much for what he was leaving out as for what he did say. She already knew that Dottie's baby girl had died, Minerva Joy, named for herself, and she swallowed the lump in her throat for the thousandth time. Hal had sent her the grievous news months ago, and she had wanted to go to her daughter at once, but it was November by the time she received that letter, and no ships would sail until March. Adam's letter had come in February, presumably having been delayed on the way. It was battered and rain-spotted, and he hadn't put a date on it, blast him. And he had added the news that caused her to send for Rafe and Mick O'Higgins at once. So now we get to this, but we get to it through a way that gives you a lot of backstory about her, her family, what's been going on in the last book and all that. Quote, "I swore I would keep his secret, Mother, but I can't do it any longer. He's alive. I can't say more, but what is happening is very terrible. I can't tell Father. Please, will you come?" "There he is," Rafe spoke suddenly, jerking her from her thoughts. "Who?" "The big fella," he said, respect in his voice. Minnie had now and then seen a whale in the channel, but seldom more than one, and always at such a distance as to look like nothing more than an intermittent gray lump, spouting steam before disappearing, like a small and very mobile volcano. The big fella rose slowly up from the depths beside the ship, a truly huge blue ghost, great flukes whiter than the ship, rising and falling under the waves, keeping silent time to a song she sensed but couldn't hear. And slowly, it seemed forever, but could have been no more than three breaths, it dived, smooth as the water itself, and vanished into the depths. "Oh," she said very softly, and Rafe nodded. "That's a very lucky thing to see, Your Grace. We'll have good fortune, see if we don't." And that's the conclusion of the introductory scene here. Okay, so presumably we kept our eyes more or less on Minnie, and presumably we also picked up the salient facts that her second son has sent her a letter urging her to come at once, but she doesn't know why, but she will come at once because all of her sons and her husband are in America and involved in the Revolutionary War. So obviously she needs to come. Okay, we've met the O'Higginses in an earlier, but for those who haven't, we've described them at some point, mostly letting them do it themselves by the way they talk and what they say. You see the personality there. So stepping back here, let's look at the focus. As I said in the beginning paragraph, we used the not knowing motif to carry people through it and establish, you know, who she is and what her background is, in case people have never read any of the stories involving her before. And a little further down, we put in the information that that she's a duchess and that she's middle-aged, because that's why she's engaged these Irishmen. This is also how you slip in information that you don't want people to consciously think about, but you want them to have, is to put something more interesting next to it. Now here, we introduce you to the very picturesque Rafe O'Higgins, and slide in that he and his brother are with her, you know, both for protection but also as disguise, because they can go places where a middle-aged English woman, let alone a duchess, so we know that she's a middle-aged English woman and she is a duchess, and since she's then is mentioning Hal, if you've never read one of my books, you would not necessarily know who Hal is, but you might easily assume that he is in fact a duke, which he is. Okay, now we did the not knowing repetition, and what I'm going to do here is show you where I passed the rhythm from one paragraph to another. We repeated the not knowing. Okay, and the next paragraph begins, "and not knowing what her husband would do next," and that's where we slip into whatever. So the eye picks up that not knowing, so immediately you're in the second paragraph, whether you wanted to be or not. Okay, and then she says, "Nobody wants to sit on a bloody knife edge," which is, you know, sort of eye-catching as a line of dialogue. And this is where we introduce the O'Higgins. And he just comes in with a low Irish laugh, which tells us who he is. So we're beginning to look into the fog, you know, okay, there's an Irishman standing behind her. What does he look like? What's he going to say? And he says, because it's sharp or because it's boring. Okay, and so this is a question. Anytime you ask a question or imply a question, the reader intuitively wants the answer. You know, it doesn't matter if they were interested to start with. If you ask a question, to anybody, they'll answer it usually. If you just are walking down the hallway, as one does here, and you say, how are you? People will automatically say, oh, I'm great, you know, whether they are or not, because they feel compelled to respond to your question. Likewise, if you run up to a policeman and say, I'm lost, they might be polite and so forth. But if you run up and say, where is, you know, Salisbury Cathedral, they'll say, it's that way, ma'am, and so forth. So they will, anyway, it's the thing about a question mark. It's very interesting, but it provokes attention. I mean, you don't want to overuse it and have question, well, actually, you do want to have questions up and down your page, but most of them don't have question marks on them. Okay, so he immediately responds with a question because it's sharp or because it's boring. Okay, so you're wondering, what's she going to reply to that? And she says, well, it does stop you dancing. And so you get the idea that these people are engaged in repartee, so to speak. They know each other well. You don't have to tell them that, anybody that. You can see it. Okay, she glanced at Rafe O'Higgins, who'd come up to the rail beside her, and now we get a look at him. He's already been introduced to us, and so we're still curious about what does he look like. Okay, now we're going to see. He wore a caped greatcoat of fine blue wool, kept a hand on his new hat to save it flying away. At a glance, he looked like a gentleman, which he most certainly was not. So we don't, you know, try to describe his face or anything like that. We describe, you know, his outward appearance, you know, hat, great coat, he's blue. But we know his character from the way she describes his looks. He's certainly not a gentleman. And she asks him, can you smell the land? Which, again, is a question. You know, with a question mark, we expect to hear the answer. And that makes us think, can you smell land? What does it smell like? You know, so you want to read the next paragraph to find out. Well, if you're smelling something and someone asks, can you smell something, what do? You sniff. So he does. He sniffed deeply and shook his head. Not yet, darling. Captain says it'll be 3 days yet, maybe four. Okay, so we already knew we were on a ship, but now we know we're approaching land, which makes us wonder, you know, where are we going? What's going to happen when we get there? Why is she on a ship with someone who is not a gentleman? And so, you know, already the questions are building up, most of which will be answered in the course of the first chapter, but they're not all going to be answered here. But we are leading people along. And we did hide a few things in there, like, you know, what Adam's letter actually meant. You know, we know it's alarming, but we don't know why. But we should be, you know, sort of prickling up our ears to find out. So anyway, she asks him, can he smell land? And he says, not yet. She stamped her foot with impatience. You know, she really wants to get ashore. Only a small stamp, and we note the repetition of stamp, stamp again, which resonates. He laughed at her and lifted his face, laughed and lifted. You know, I have a thing for alliteration. I use it wherever I can, but subtly, it shouldn't pop out at people. And here is the rule of three. If you tell someone something twice, well, if you tell them something once, they might notice, but they won't remember it. If you tell them something twice, they will remember it. If you tell them something three times, they'll notice it consciously. And, you know, they'll either respond to it or embed it deeply in their memory. Okay, so about focus, this is one of the ways that you can do that. If you refer to something more than once, it's going to draw the reader's attention to it. You mention it once, it'll slip by unless you make a point of it. Okay, so what does a whale smell like, pray, she asked. Diverted, despite herself, diverted, despite, and don't say fish. Okay, what does a whale smell like, pray? Okay, this is passing the smell from the previous paragraph. Fish, I smell fish, and a whale. And what does a whale smell like, pray? So we're following the smell down the page now. Your eye is still picking it up. And we're also repeating the word whale, and a whale. And what does a whale smell like? And he replies, oh, whales have a strange smell about them. So we repeated the smell and the whale together. You can see that we're sort of walking down this page, you know, like descending a staircase, right, being passed by the words from place to place. Good luck, we're also absorbing the meaning and enjoying what we're doing. But the thing is that your attention will follow that without you being consciously aware of it. Oh, whales have a strange smell about them. This is where audiobooks have a slight problem. And I've heard people say, well, I don't like audiobooks because I have trouble, you know, keeping my attention on them. It's just going on in my ear. Mm-hmm. That's because you cannot see this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You don't see the words, you know, that should be drawing your focus down the page. You have to depend on what's actually happening, just on the drama and, you know, the actor's capabilities, which is great. I like audiobooks myself. But this is one reason why written books have more of an impact. You're much more likely to remember what you read than something that you heard in an audiobook, and that's why. Okay, so whales have a strange smell about them, he said, narrowing his eyes against the wind. You don't get close enough to smell it often, mind, which is only reasonable, but repeating the smell again. But now and again, one will come up beside your wee boat when you're fishing in the Irish Sea and let out his breath in a mighty blast. Okay, we've got boat, breath, blast, you know, floating through that. And we are rapidly forming a vision of him sitting in a wee boat in the Irish Sea and waiting for a whale to rise beside him, which is a very vivid mental picture without my having to paint in the whale. And smells, again, of hot and cold, rotten life, racks of seaweed, and thousands and millions of rancid little things that have thin shells like the nail of your smallest finger. That was the best I could get to describing krill without saying krill. It's, you know, it just doesn't go in an 18th century manuscript. And besides, he's a poetic Irishman, so we get a little more of his character going with that. They stick in the whale's teeth, or what pass for teeth in a whale. In other words, they mean whales, is what he means. There are toothed whales, which are things like dolphins and orcas, which are the largest toothed whales. Well, actually, sperm whales also have teeth. They are the biggest. But most of the other smaller whales, like right whales, humpbacks, etc., they all have what are called baleen in their mouths, which are like plates of compressed fiber with loose fibers around the edge. And so basically they take in a huge mouthful of whatever they're swimming through and then, you know, shut their baleen and blow the water out through it. So, you know, think of it as brushing your teeth, and instead of spitting after you've rinsed, you go. So they do that, and that means they're left with a mass of, you know, relatively dry krill that they can then swallow. Just in case you didn't know that. And he added practically tons of seaweed and the odd fish, because when they, you know, bring in seawater, you know, whatever's swimming in it is what they're going to catch in their mouths. So they're not actually hunting fish or after them, but they will swallow them and digest the protein just like they do krill. Anyway, so your usual whale's not picky, which is, you know, both true and, you know, Irish of him. So we're following on down. Okay. Now, this is just a statement that he's been making, and so there's nothing for her to openly respond to. And she says, "You don't say." She'd engaged, and thus this gives us the focus to say, why is this a problem, or why does she notice that? She says she'd engaged the O'Higgins brothers as much for their conversation as for their protection while traveling. So our focus starts with being on their conversation. Yeah, this is why they're standing together. She's hired him to come along, and he is an entertaining talker. But then we lead you directly into the real reason for their protection while traveling, and their ability, which makes you wonder, where are they going again? And their ability to ask questions in the sorts of places an English gentlewoman couldn't go, let alone a duchess. Okay, so we are following the reason why they're there, their ability to ask questions in odd places, and then we slip in the information that she's a gentlewoman and a duchess. You wouldn't think about much about that consciously, because you're still wondering about where she's going and what she's going to do there. The usual whale, you say. Are there unusual ones? She didn't bother asking how he might know the O'Higginses got around. And that's just a little bit of backstory about the O'Higginses. Okay, we already think that they're probably a bit of low life because of the fingers and the whore and things like that. But this is just reiterating that the O'Higginses got around. This is also convenient, as it's what I call an indefinite focus, as in it's a definite, you know, state of fact, and gives you a mental picture of what's going on, but you don't know exactly what that means. However, it gives you the footing, so to speak, for the O'Higginses to kind of come and go mysteriously and do anything that needs being done without you having to go to the trouble of describing where they are and what they're doing. You know, they just show up with whatever it is that you need, or that many needs in this case, and nobody questions it because the O'Higginses got around. They have their ways, and we don't need to know what they are unless they're germane to the story. So we cover that without detail, as I say. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, well, he considered. There's your sperm whale, sure. Now I have a reason for this, but look at the sperm whale, sure. And then a great huge fellow, which is Irish dialect, more or less, and he eats great huge squid. Now you see this often in Irish people who are speaking English, that they'll repeat a specific picturesque phrase as part of the emphasis of the conversation. And they will occasionally say sure when they are, you know, looking for an interpolatory word. Yeah. Great huge fellow and eats great huge squid, or so I'm told. And given the stink of even a small squid that's been left out so too long, I think the smell of the big fellow's breath must be one to knock you off your feet. Okay, you didn't even notice the S's passing through there. Small squid left out, and smell, etc. The stink of a small squid and the smell. Your eye followed those without you necessarily concentrating on that. And then when you reach the smell of the big fellow's breath, must be one to knock you off your feet. Okay, there's not any soothing repetition in that one, so you're paying attention to each word, and it has more impact there. So we're thinking about whales, and specifically sperm whales. Lenny's response, I hope I live to smell one, if only for the experience. And he replies, you've always been a great one for experience, Your Grace, he said laughing. So far we have been passing the baton so far all the way down this scene by repeating phrases and words from one paragraph to the next, but doing it inconspicuously, I hope. Anyway, she says, you should talk, he said, unoffended. In other words, yes, he has a lot of experience. And then told me again how you came to lose your finger. Okay, and that's a question, which he's then going to answer with another question, which one? You know, and so this is again going to lead us along here, and he tells the story about the whore and the ring and all that. And to the end, oh, I don't believe that for a moment, she said gravely, that she was sucking your finger, I mean. Okay, and then we return to more closer attention. She was sucking a number of things, he said, lifting one shoulder in a shrug. I dare say I lost track. Okay, so not only is that funny, but we're returning to our sibilance and our alliteration that's leading me down. So now we're going inside Minnie's mind again. Minnie herself had long since lost track of the number of stories he'd told regarding the loss of his digits, but he could always think of a new one. And he had, as usual, succeeded in distracting her mind, if only for a few precious moments, from the thoughts that weighed upon it. Even now her hand was creeping under her cloak, creeping cloak, and into the, you're following her hand because you're following the creeping of the cloak, and into the slit in her petticoat to find her pocket, petticoat pocket, and touch the letter inside. When you stop doing alliteration, then people pay much more attention to the words that are not alliterative. So alliteration is, it's for rhythm and poesy, but it's also just to control, you know, as I say, the focus. You convey the information as you need it, but without making a big point of it. Whereas when you stop and say things bluntly and, you know, not words of a single syllable, but in discrete words that are not following, you know, a rhythmic pattern, then that focuses the reader's attention on what that particular thing was. And touch the letter inside. Okay, she's got a hidden letter. Okay, this raises an unarticulated question. You know, we want to know what's in the letter, who wrote it. Okay, so the next paragraph answers that, Adam. We don't know who Adam is, probably, but Adam seldom wrote a proper letter. Okay, so she's disturbed because he has written her a proper letter. So now we really want to know what's in that letter, and who is Adam. Anyway, her second son, which answers the question, and we return to the essence, had inherited, or possibly consciously imitated, though she didn't want to suspect him of that, his father's habit of seldom either addressing or signing letters, and using the minimum number of words to convey whatever was on his mind. Got the essence going along, leading you through that because this is a thought. And it's linking Adam to his father, whom we know nothing about at this point, except that she considers marriage to him to be mostly blissful, but not right this minute. So it makes us wonder, you know, what is it about Adam and what is he with his father? Are they getting into trouble? Yeah, but he'd addressed this one, dear mother, and signed it as well, adding, your most obedient, humble, and loving son, which is the way that the 18th century man would sign a letter to, you know, a dear one. Which frightened her, as did the body of the letter. And we're wondering why she frightened him by that particular closing. And as much for what he was leaving out as for what he did say. That refers back to his father's habit of seldom addressing or signing letters and using the minimum number of words to convey whatever was in his mind. So we're already prepared for Adam to have written her a fairly short letter, and we're just hoping that he's going to give her an answer to her curiosity. Okay, she already knew that Dottie's baby girl had died. This was stuff we learned in another book. So it's something that we need to know about her, but it's not the main focus of anything at the moment. It's just there. And, you know, lump is, well, it's a kind of a lumpish word. It's just there. It's very solid. You would notice it, so you don't need to repeat it. And she swallowed the lump in her throat for the thousandth time. Liberation. Okay, Hal, who is her husband, figured that one out, I think, had sent her the grievous news months ago, and she'd wanted to go to her daughter at once, because of course he would. But it was November by the time she'd received that letter, and no ships would sail until March. Okay, that's actually true. You know, in the 18th century, nobody sailed during the winter because there were hurricanes, and we've seen what they can do. Yeah, especially to a small sailing ship. My motive for doing that was not only just to reiterate 18th century stuff, this interesting background, but to explain why she's only going in March when all this had happened in the previous book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have tied that up, and one needs to work on wonder about why she wasn't there at her daughter's side and so forth. Adam's letter had come in February, so it's the implication is that she has found a ship right away after receiving his letter, and they're sailing as soon as is physically possible, i.e. in March. In other words, it's very urgent. He didn't say exactly what was wrong, but she knows it's urgent. She's going to go, presumably having been delayed on the way, and then had to put that in because I've already told you that ships stopped sailing in November, and she didn't get it till March. So presumably it was on one of those ships that wasn't sailing. It was battered and rain-spotted, because it would be, and he hadn't put a date on it, blast him, and had added the news that caused her to send for Rafe and Nick O'Higgins at once. So that's very unvarnished, you know, we're just explaining where she, at this point, where she is and what's going on. But we've got you through all of her backstory and quite a bit of her things. So we've set the setting, we've introduced the O'Higginses and their motive, and so forth. So we've got, you know, character motive. Okay, we're working our way through who, it's Minnie. What, we're getting to that, but we know more or less where, we know exactly where, she's on a ship in the ocean, we don't quite know where she's going yet, but theoretically she does, when, we know it's March of whatever year it is, and why, we know why she's received this letter. Okay, so already we've answered all of the five W's of a journalistic thing. If I were writing this as a newspaper article, it would pass muster on those grounds, probably no others, but that one. Okay. I swore I would keep his secret, mother, but I can't do it any longer. He's alive. I can't say more, but what is happening is very terrible. I can't tell father. Please, will you come? Yes, no. Minnie has a pretty good idea of who it is that's alive, but I didn't want to give that away, so I left it out. Adam is being very typically terse, you know, he would think that was enough, you know, as it is for Minnie, but, you know, it keeps it from the reader. So that's a focus that you deliberately deprive the reader of until later. Yeah, that's something where you don't want them to look too closely. You want them to understand the urgency of the letter, but you don't want them to know exactly where she's going or for what purpose, just that it's urgent and it's family. There he is. Rafe spoke suddenly, jerking her from her thoughts. Again, this is a good way to change focus, is to have somebody speak about a different subject or make a loud noise, he heard the thump of the axe hitting the wall behind him before he saw it, something like that. But, you know, he could be speaking to a friend and suddenly there's a loud thunk and turn around. Yeah, and then the guy nushes up with a long sword and there's a big fight and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, we don't need to focus on that until we come to where they are actually face to face. So distraction is one thing that you can use. And it's, usually something sudden that is not connected to what you've been writing. It's an outside interference that gives you a dislocation. And at that point, you can change your focus to do almost anything. You can go back into internal thoughts. You can have action begin to happen, which is what happens here. Or you can, kind of change your scene entirely. You know, there's a shout from the back of the ship that made Rafe, drop his hat and run. And of course, we're going to follow the story that way. So this is one other thing about focus. Motion is a good way to do it and to deflect, either to center focus, to follow the focus, or to deflect it. So if you describe someone doing something, for instance, I'm just standing here talking to you, you're not really noticing that I have a drink with me. If I picked it up and took a drink, you would notice immediately, oh, she drinks Diet Coke, she must be a caffeine addict. Let's see, I've been sitting here all this time and you haven't noticed it. I put it down and possibly some of you saw it then, but you've forgotten about it. So I can bring it back by just lifting it. It doesn't take much motion at all because we are animals, basically. And we grew up as both predator and prey, as we evolved, I should say. I hope you're all grown up by this time. Yeah, the thing is, that's why we are sensitive to movement. Because if you're, walking through the forest or sitting there, you know, munching your papaya, if you hear something in the grass that's going, you freeze. Because you think you know what that is and you don't want to move suddenly. If you hear sitting in the forest and you hear something going, you probably get up and run. Is it moving slowly and you don't think it's a snake? Likewise, if you are looking for food, you are walking along looking for that and listening for motion, you know. You hear a bird in the tree, is it a kind of bird that you might want to eat? No, it's a hawk, okay? You want to know where that hawk is going because he can see what you can't see, so you're following the hawk at that point. Yeah, but any kind of motion attracts our attention because it was a matter of life and death.
And so, by the same token, not life and death, exactly. But if you insert motion, the reader's eye will follow it, no matter what kind of motion it is. You know, you will remember exactly what I'm saying at the moment because I'm walking back and forth in front of you. You may not remember anything else I said, but remember that. So anyway, you can use this to your own advantage. Just be careful that you don't make the, don't usually make the motion the focus of the story, of the paragraph, unless it's an important motion, you know, like someone being shot in the chest and falling over backward, that, then you can focus on that. Okay, so there he is. Rafe spoke suddenly, jerking her from her thoughts. She replies, "Who?" "The big fella," he said, respect in his voice. Minnie had now and then seen a whale in the channel, but seldom more than one, and always at such a distance as to look like nothing more than an intermittent gray lump, spouting steam before disappearing like a small and very mobile volcano. Okay, so we're just describing the whale in, you know, metaphorical or simile to draw your eye to it and to actually look at it, and there's a reason for that. Okay, we don't just say, oh, there's a whale over there, and leave it at that. You know, we don't look at the whale and think about the whale and so forth. There's two separate reasons for doing this. One is that he's just about to appear. The big fella rose slowly up from the depths beside the ship. A huge, truly huge, and I'm repeating it, blue ghost, great flukes wider than the ship, which they really were. Ships were not all that big at the time, as sperm whales are, in fact, really big. They're not as big as blue whales, but blue whales wouldn't fit here because they're not baleen whales. Rising and falling under the waves, keeping silent time to a song she sensed but couldn't hear. Silent song, sensed, etc. We're cruising again. And slowly, it seemed forever, but could have been no more than three breaths, it dived, smooth as the water itself, and vanished into the depths. Okay, we expect that to be a little bit poetic because we want the whale to seem, you know, mysterious and frightening, and or at least something worthy of respect, or focus our attention on it. Oh, she said very softly, and Rafe nodded. That's a very lucky thing to see, Your Grace. We'll have good fortune to see if we don't. Okay, so we reiterate here that they're on a quest of some kind. He's helping her with whatever it is that Adam has written to her about. Okay, so at this point, with luck, you have given your reader enough that they want to go on and write and read what happens next. Okay, so that's, you know, like two pages. So that's not bad as an introduction to get across that much information without, you know, dumping it on the reader, so to speak. Right. The second reason for introducing the whale here is that a whale enters the plot somewhere else in the book, or there's a whale. And I wanted that echo of it to linger in the reader's mind by making something of a visual impression on them. Because if you say, oh, there's a whale over there, people just think spout, you know, and they're not going to pay much attention if you get the vision of the spouting like an intermittent volcano and seeing them rise up and the big flukes and all that. That's going to linger in your mind. And then when you meet the whale much, much later in the story, you're going to carry that with you. You'll have this sense of awe and, you know, respect about it. All right. This would be a good place probably for me to stop for breath and ask if any of you have any questions. Yeah.
How do you stay illiterate without being told that you sing songs?
Read what you're writing out loud, and also don't make the alliteration the point of the paragraph or whatever. Write out what is the thought that you want to convey, and then look at it and say, well, how could I rephrase that slightly? Also, read the whole rest of the paragraph. Does anything come out to you in terms of an interesting sound or whatever? If so, then maybe you can pick that up. Yeah, but I mean, never use alliteration just for its own sake. You use it, you know, to express the thought. It's just that sometimes there are multiple words that you could use to express that same thought. And if the alliteration has to fall naturally, I mean, none of you would have noticed that alliteration at all had I not pointed it out to you while I was reading. Yes, it should be something subconscious, but it is something, like I say, the rhythm, and there are other, you know, linguistic rhythms that you use to carry the reader along, and those are just ones that you develop on your own. And mind you, some stories are just not rhythmic or melodic or anything like that, and they work perfectly well. This is just, you know, one technique that you can use, and I'm suggesting you use it all the time. Yeah. As for contrast, there is a very interesting book, and I hope it's still in print. It's called Kiss of the Spider Woman. Mm. And you've read it, or seen it. And yes, it's by a South American writer named Manuel Puig, P-U-I-G. And the entire content is an ongoing conversation between two prisoners in a South American jail, Brett Pichgar, and they are each other's only company. You know, they never see anybody else. They have no light, no form of recreation, really. They obviously have nothing in common. One is a revolutionary student, and the other guy is a gay hairdresser. And so they're sitting there in the dark, and they have no one else to talk to but each other. So the entire book is the conversation between them, which is shown over, several days or weeks or whatever, but it's only dialogue. You never see anything because they're sitting in the dark. And there's no backstory. We don't know why they were arrested. We don't know who they were before they came here, other than they're a student and obviously a gay hairdresser. And that the gay hairdresser has a taste for romantic movies and things like that, and soap operas. And so they've exhausted the, what they want to tell each other about their lives and so forth. And so the hairdresser says, well, I saw this great movie, the last week before I was arrested. And the student says, tell me about it, because, I want to hear anything, at this point. And so he begins telling the story of the movie briefly. And so the whole novel, it's a short one, is told this way in dialogue back and forth. We're referring to the content of the movies as the substance between them. And, at a certain point, this takes place over weeks, but they become closer and closer, of course, because they are each other's only resource, and eventually end up having a sexual encounter, which the student, as he said, I'd let you do that to me, but I think it would hurt. And the hairdresser said, well, I could make sure it didn't, but we won't do it unless you want to. It just shows you how much you can get without any kind of surrounding description. In that one, the focus is always on the next line of dialogue, and so it's the story itself that's carrying the weight of that. But there's nothing whatever to describe their surroundings or even what happens outside the prison or anything. It's just this little world to a man with their experiences. Yeah, so that's it. I'd recommend it. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the book again?
Oh, Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is the name of a particular film.
Can I ask online?
Yeah.
If you could repeat it in the mic after
sure.
I say it, so they can hear it. Thank
sure.
you. Mm-hmm. Is what you're narrating for us approximately what is going through your mind as you're writing, or how much is conscious versus unconscious?
Oh, is what I'm telling you or reading to you here. What's going through my mind as I'm writing, or how much of it is conscious versus unconscious? Well, it's always pretty conscious, because you have to be exercising choice all of the time. What word, what is it that I'm trying to say here? And I don't really worry about what I'm trying to say here. There's a rhythm to the events as well. I mean, we have a woman on a ship, and she's going somewhere to do something. Okay, that's as much as I knew who the woman was, and I know where she was going and what she was going to do when she got there. Other than that, I knew nothing when I started this. But of course, I'm thinking as I begin to describe it. But that's why I started with her name, Minnie. Okay, and I was thinking, well, who is Minnie? Well, I know who Minnie is, and she's always liked uncertainty as one of her defining characteristics. She's a gambler, and she will do rash things, even though she's wise enough to think about them first and list aid. And so I'm thinking this while I was writing that. But the first thing was, Minnie had always liked uncertainty, because that was the main thing that I knew, who she was and what her defining characteristic is. That's what it is. And so then I still didn't have anything much in mind, so I went on with it. And I just picked up on uncertainty, because that was the only word that had any future, you might say. So I said, not knowing whether the book she'd rummaged out of an attic in Paris, because she was a used book dealer, or her father was, and she would go and find and buy books for him. And so I'm thinking, okay, backstory, all right. I mean, you don't normally start with the main character's backstory on the first paragraph, but why not? Yeah, so we have this, because this plays into her uncertainty. And I had, as I say, written that story, Fugitive Green, which has a lot of her, pawing through attics and studies of deceased patrons and so forth to look for books. And she's, you know, always talking, thinking, you know, oh, this is Granny Tim, or going into the Duke study, and he's saying, well, there's nothing. She's just been stealing something out of his desk drawer. And he says, well, there's nothing worth stealing in this library. And she's looking over his shoulder and thinking that at least 10 of the books on his shelf were worth £1,000 each. But of course, this sinks into nothing as compared to the letters that she's just stole, the letters she has just put back after having stolen them. So, you know, that's a different thing, because there you're comparing, you know, value as a subtext. Subtext is a whole different thing than what I've been discussing here. Subtext is, you know, kind of the character's inner thoughts, which are, or their personality, which you're going to reveal, but you're not going to say it explicitly. So if I just said, Minnie liked uncertainty, you would know something about her, and you'd be watching her to see, you know, how that evolved. As it is, I was explicit here because it was the beginning of the story, and you know, you have to put words on the page to start with. I think somebody famously said, you can't fix a blank page. In other words, you have to get words on the page. And just as a subsidiary footnote here, that is actually the essence of writing, is putting words on a page. You know, this is the sine qua non. You can't be a writer if you don't put words on the page. It doesn't matter if you write it longhand with a quill on a word processor with chalk on a board. You have to do the actual manual work of putting words down. This makes synapses in your brain fire. You get more done if you are typing things than if you're just thinking about them. At least I do. Some people like to outline their books, and I know many people who do, to good effect and so forth. I cannot work that way. It just does not work. If I could have done this, I would be thinking. I think I have a beneficial form of ADHD in which I actually do think about 8 things at once. And so, yes, these are rotating in my mind. You know, I just pick which one is shiniest at the moment. We go from there. But what this amounts to is that I write in pieces. Yeah, and sometimes I will get only 2 or 3 paragraphs out of a sudden surge of adrenaline, and then that's it. You know, nothing else is showing up. I don't bother, you know, standing there and drying my hair and saying, oh, I'll go have a drink and come back and see if it's any better. I just, you know, open a new file and start with the next thought that's floating around in my head. And or I go back to an earlier thing that I had abandoned because it wasn't working. And when I read through it, often those things do start working the second time you see them, because the back of your mind has been working on it while you were otherwise occupied. Yeah, but it is important to write. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get anything written if you don't show up for work. That's basically how it works. It's you and the book. The book's not going to work by itself. They're very lazy. yes.
So, quite a lot of positive examples of focusing.
Yeah.
You focus and draw attention to one thing or another. But, and you can focus for instance in workshop, but was there a negative example that maybe I missed where you were drawing or focused away from something to either like see or anything like that? In that example, just did, or is that?
Yeah, well, there's Ben's letter, you know, in which she is reading this. I didn't go into any detail at all about what she knows about Adam or what she thinks might be the situation that's going on that he's referring to. I just dropped it and switched smoothly to we're near land and can you smell whales and things like that. And the whales are fascinating enough that you wouldn't need to go back and wonder, well, why isn't she telling us any more about the letter? And leaving the letter where it is, you know, just leaves that little mysterious kernel planted. We can pick it up anywhere else that seems useful. Yeah, this is, yeah, distraction, the magpie effect, you know, shiny object. Yes, this always works in literature. Just, you know, put in something more interesting. Yeah.
So you said action draws your focus.
Yes.
So let's say that you want the reader to focus on just the words the characters are saying. Mm-hmm. Would you still recommend adding in character actions like shrugging, nodding, those kind of things just so they can see the scene, or is that going to draw their focus somewhere that you don't want?
Well, that's individual judgment, and it's more a matter of rhythm. Ordinarily, if you're trying to write, you know, crisp dialogue that is not distracted by other things, you put each line of dialogue on a separate line. You don't add anything before or after it. In other cases, where what they're saying implies something else or has a greater meaning, or someone is putting meaning on what they're saying, you might put it at the beginning of a paragraph and then continue on from that. If I can find an example in a minute. I was telling you about the 8 different things. Returning to one of those, which is putting words on paper. You probably all know that I have a TV show. It doesn't belong to me, but I feel possessive about it. Based on my books. and luckily, the producers wanted me to work with them, which I have enjoyed tremendously over the last 10 years. So I've written scripts for them, and you know, I've sat in on writers' room conferences, and I answer questions, and I really tell them things that I think they should do, and things like that. But anyway, in the course of this, during public events to promote the show, I rub up against the act, not physically, well, well, there's one exception, but yeah. He's hard to avoid. Yeah. No. Plus, I mislead you. I'm not sure quite how this started, but Sam Heughan kisses me every time we meet each other and every time we leave each other. It's just sort of our little thing. I mean, it's not like they kiss, it's just. The first time my daughter saw him kiss me, I'm leaving the place, she was like, Mom! So anyway, yes, other than that, I don't touch them. Other than, you know, the friendly hug and so forth, that's fine. So anyway, actors, yes, through the course of many years of being, fairly comfortable with most of them, quite a number of them, all men, I don't know why, I think men are just more private about things like this, but many of them have come up, I mean, they're just making conversation, come up and said, well, I'm really interested, you know, in writing a book, you know, about my experiences and so forth. That's everybody in the film industry thinks they have very memorable experiences, which I'm sure they do. But anyway, they say, how do I start? You know, I mean, how would I go about learning to write a book? How would I write a book? And I said, well, it's a simple exercise. It's very easy. Take 10 minutes every day for a week. Just 10 minutes, no more, no less. Set a timer if you want to. Just take 10 minutes and put words down. It doesn't matter what you're writing about. Write about what you see out the window. Write about, you know, that your foot hurts because you dropped an iron on it in the last scene. Whatever you want. Just write anything for 10 minutes. Okay? So that by the end of the week, you'll know whether you want to write a novel or not, and you will feel comfortable starting. None of them have ever made it past three pages in three days. Except Sam Heughan, who did actually write a whole book, but he didn't ask me first. As most people who want to write a book would not, they would just go ahead and do it. Yeah, Hal, speaking of.
You yesterday said that you write extremely slowly.
I do.
These kernels. Mm-hmm. How many kernels a day? I mean, I'm trying to picture the productivity. Yeah. That,
well, usually only one, because if it starts a scene, then I just proceed with it. Yeah, and that can stretch over several days. But when I don't know where to start, I go looking for another kernel, which is just, you know, any source of inspiration, anything that strikes my eye. You know, I could use a Diet Coke can as a kernel if I were writing a contemporary novel. I'd say, the can of Diet Coke stood reproachfully on the table, reminding her that she ought really to be drinking skim milk for breakfast. That just wasn't feasible today. but anything that lets you get words on the page. So I would be looking for a kernel just as a place to start. Sometimes the original kernel actually doesn't mean anything, and it evaporates, and I go back and forth. Most often it is embedded somewhere in what I'm writing. In this case, Minnie was the kernel standing at the rail of a ship. I could see her. Yeah, and so that's where I started. Yeah, it's not always that clear. Yeah.
Kind of technical question about your
sure.
research. Obviously, historical fiction, there's tons of research that goes mm-hmm. into it
yeah.
and can distract from productivity. But in this scene, for example, I picked up that you're talking about a whale. Mm-hmm. Did you have previous knowledge of whales, or did you think of using a whale and then stop and say, okay, I got to go research and do this sort of sidebar research on whales and come back and add that?
Well, that's a double-ended answer. I have a master's degree in marine biology from Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I have read the whales chapter in Moby Dick. Which, if you actually know anything about whales, is really funny. So I know a lot about whales is the thing. But, you know, whales also are so iconic just by themselves, you know, that you're tempted to use them as a symbol. I mean, Herman Melville got away with it, you know, why not? So this is not a white whale, by the way, but the second whale who shows up, that one should echo back with this one, and to Ray O'Higgins's remark about, we'll have good luck, see if we don't. That's a double-edged Irish thing, see if we don't. We might not. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
in that case, it was a whale, but in other cases, do you, you're coming across a scene and you're thinking of, okay, I want this to be in that scene, but I now I need to go research that?
It depends on what it is. If it's something that's really integral to the scene, then I'll go and look it up, but it's usually quick. If it's not integral to the scene, but yet that it needs to be there, I just put a square brackets and put the word tree or house or, you know, whatever inside it. You know, if I'm writing about people going through the woods, he's pushing a branch out of his face, I could leave it at that, but it has more impact if you say he pushed a sycamore branch out of his face. That plants you more firmly in where you are, especially if the branch has a smell to it. I think I mentioned in some other place the rule of three. There's a lot of rules of three, but this one is from Gustave Flaubert, and I learned it by accident. But he said in one conversation external to his books that if you use any three of the five senses, the scene that you're writing will instantly become three-dimensional and have much more life. So most people would use, you know, sight and sound. He saw this, so he said this about it, and so forth, and he replied that about it, and so forth, and he was wearing a red shirt, and that sort of thing. But if you say, I totally not mean anything personal, but it's, he was wearing a gray t-shirt, and sneezed loudly and wiped his nose on his sleeve, you observe that, you don't remember this guy. You would never do something like that. Yes.
Regarding the sycamore tree, so if you include that detail, doesn't that imply that the character knows that it's a sycamore tree?
It
does. What if you're writing a character that doesn't know very much about the world? Like, how would you paint a good picture with specifics?
He pushed the branch out of his face and was surrounded in a shower of fragrant leaves. The sycamore leaves smell earthy, but he doesn't need to know it's a sycamore. No, as it is, this particular person does know it's a sycamore because he's been there for a while. No, it's also a matter of rhythm and detail. You don't want to clog your story with too many details. You know, if the guy's running through the brush, he's not going to notice what kind of brush he's running through, unless, you know, he runs deliberately into a dogwood bush for reasons unknown and trips over and falls down. But because that will give you a more vivid mental image of where he is. But if he's just hurtling down the mountainside, it would be more, you know, his breath was, you know, his heartbeat was pounding in his ears. And he narrowly avoided the tuft of grass in his path, something like that. Yeah, but you don't need to get all specific about species names and so forth. Yeah, oh, the other thing about research, the only time I would do preliminary research in depth is for a historical event, more likely, or if there's a particular place that I know I will need to know a lot about, like Paris. Well, I needed just to know the geography of it, basically, so I could not have people in the wrong arrondissement for what I intended them to do. But at the moment, the only intense research that I have or intend to do is for the Battle of Yorktown, which was a huge battle that took several weeks and involved all kinds of people, many of whom are in my story. So I need to know where everybody was at what time and what happened in the progress of the battle. How did it develop? Because it was called a battle, but they weren't fighting every single day. It was a siege, you know, the siege of Yorktown. That is always described as the battle. Because there was, at least, I think there were two actual battles, actually not more than that. And in the course of this, I learned that Alexander Hamilton, whom we know all about, actually had been dying to, you know, actually fight militarily, and he wasn't allowed to because he was too valuable to Washington as an aide-de-camp. And finally he begged and pleaded, and in the very final battle of Yorktown, he was allowed to lead a small regiment of militia, and they captured Redoubt Number 10. If you Google Redoubt Number 10, you'll find out all about it. Anyway, he won and then captured the readout and so forth, so he felt very triumphant about that until he met Aaron Burr. Yeah. So anyway, so you find out lots of interesting little things like that. So having found that out, I will undoubtedly say something about Alexander Hamilton, who I might otherwise not have included in that part of the story. But if I do include him, then he was a very well-known figure, and he wrote a lot of stuff. So I know I can find out what he sounded like, you know, what the cadence of his speech would be like. And, you know, I know he was sharp-minded just from his reputation, but if I read, you know, some of the Federalist Papers, I will see how he thought. And I can then use that as background for rendering him. when I deal with a historical person, I always try, I mean, there's only so much you can know about them, but I try to not make them look any worse than the worst thing I know that they did. So, you know, George Washington owned slaves. Okay, this is fine. I can mention his slaves. And, you know, do I want to focus on the fact that he was a slave owner? Probably not. But if the person talking to him was from the future and knew he owned slaves, that might, you know, color their attitude toward him, or might not, depending on the circumstances. It's just another thing that you know about someone, and, you know, it's a matter of perception. How much do you want to emphasize whatever it is that you do know about them? Or again, focus, is it something that you want to ignore in favor of what they were actually doing at the time? Do you want this man to look heroic, as we did in Bees, where he's charging, you know, and regathering his troops and, you know, wins the battle that was lost by sheer force of personality. Yeah, we're not going to say, well, this guy's a slave owner. I don't care what he did. No, this is not where your focus should be. You focus on what he was doing then, which was important. If you get anything else in elsewhere. Yeah, the other thing about focus is placement. You know, where do you put the things that you know? You may have a whole list of, you know, interesting things that you know about one of your characters or their surroundings and so forth. But for artistic purposes, you don't want to put them all in at once. Or you have to, you know, dole them out sparingly, or you have to pick and choose which ones you're going to use, like Washington and slaves, for instance. I haven't had an occasion to use Thomas Jefferson, you know. It would be interesting. Mm-hmm. Approach him a little differently. Do we have another question?
We do.
Oh, good.
Sure. How much do you know about your characters or story when you start to write, especially when it's new characters versus well-established ones?
Oh, usually I don't know that much about them, but I can see them. Some, like, I should distinguish about characters. Characters to me are either mushrooms, hard nuts, or onions. Okay, the mushrooms are people who just pop up out of nowhere. I was not expecting them. I didn't plan for them to be there. They just, you know, pop up and, you know, walk off with whatever scene they're in. You know, Fergus, for instance, was a mushroom. I was not expecting him. There he is. The hard nuts are the people that I am compelled to have for either for story structural reasons or because it's historical and they were really there. If it's that, then I at least have stuff to go on because there's stuff written about them. Otherwise, you know, a fictional hard nut, well, Brianna is the all-time hard nut. She exists only because Claire was pregnant when she went back at the end of Dragonfly and Ember. And so I have this kid. I had a terrible time starting Dragonfly and Ember because I didn't know what to do with her. I was thinking, well, Claire's pregnant. You know, is she going to have a miscarriage? No, that wouldn't be right because she's carrying, you know, all that's left of Jamie, or so she thinks. Yeah, no, this kid has to be born. What kind of kid is it? Well, long-lost kid, et cetera. There's going to be a son who's going to go back and challenge Jamie. No, I don't think so. All right, it's a girl. All right, who's who? Anyway, it took me a long time to figure out who the heck she was. And I decided this is why that book starts where it does, which is, you know, when Brianna is about 18. It's because I don't like little kids in books. You normally don't want to write one about them. And also, yeah, for structural reasons, you know, it would deeply inhibit my story of Claire, you know, trying to go on a battlefield and save people, and this little brat going, mummy, mummy, mummy.
That's mine.
I've had three kids, I know. In fact, I have two grandsons, and my daughter this morning was telling me, you know, what a relief it was to be here. And not listening. Yeah, actually, they are very dear boys, and they're 5 and 7, so they can, you know, talk and so forth. The youngest two is 5. The visiting district nurse, they live in Scotland, so they come around for well child checks, essentially, you know, like every 3 or 6 months or whatever, check up on the child's development. Are they being adequately fed? You know, do they have scurvy or whatever? Anyway, kids passed with flying colors, I'm happy to say. But the nurse was making conversation, and my daughter called something in Spanish to one of the kids. She's married to a gentleman who is half Spanish, half Scottish. Okay, and my dad was a Spanish speaker from New Mexico. English was his second language, which he learned at 5 when he went to kindergarten. He speaks Spanish, but not very well. Anyway, she speaks it a lot better being married to someone who does. So they've tried to raise the kids bilingually, And so the nurse said, "Oh, can you say something in Spanish to me, León?" And he sort of glared at her and said, "C'est moi, León." Yes, he's a contrarian. Yeah, no, the kids don't like to speak Spanish. If you speak Spanish to them, they'll answer you in English. They can, they just don't want to. Did that answer the question?
Onions.
Oh, the onions, yes, I forgot the onions. Okay, an onion is a character whose inner essence I apprehend immediately. I know who this person is, but they develop layers as I work with them, and we have experiences and so forth. Both Jamie and Claire are onions. I knew them immediately, but you have to do the hard work of painting in their focuses and their layers and so forth, so that people will not be surprised when a sudden layer shows up.
When you use other languages in the dialogue, do you decide which pieces of dialogue will be in Gaelic or French, et cetera, beforehand, and then use that as a focus to maintain the flow of focus?
No, I don't usually decide ahead of time. It depends on the circumstances. If it's a person who is known only to speak French, you know, then you would have to put a French sentence in to indicate that and tell or make it obvious that they only spoke French. And then you could have someone else interpret for them, or if the person who is listening to them understands French, you can have their thoughts reflect what the person is saying. I don't ever use chunks of untranslated foreign languages, but in other cases you can have a person who speaks French but is talking to an English speaker, and they will, you know, drop, well, any language. If you're talking to someone whose language you speak but it's not your first language, your brain will just brief roadblock and you drop in the word that's in your most familiar language rather than stop and try to think what the other word is.
I guess maybe back to the research question. Mm-hmm. If you actually go to the standing stones to get more concepts of those, or the caves, you know, anywhere where they had those time travel moments, did you go and stand? Well, I'm assuming you did that with the stones.
But what do you mean, the ones in the show? They're fiberglass. They call them out and stand.
I was thinking of the first book.
Oh, yeah. There are standing stones all over Great Britain. And I knew Claire was a time traveler pretty much from the beginning. And so my question was, well, how is she going to get into the past? We don't need to worry about it right now because there's a writing for her, but eventually we're going to have to answer that. So what was her means? I mean, a time machine seems too clunky and mechanical and I wanted to keep the focus in the 18th century as she gradually submerges into it. You know, so of course she's surprised because of the little modern historic collisions that happen when you're entering a strange culture and so forth. But I didn't want her to have got there via time machine, because A, it would probably be on purpose, and B, it would just be discordant. So I was thinking, okay, how did she get there? You know, I really don't like I don't like the sort of stories where you inherit a mirror from your grandmother and you look into it and suddenly you are your grandmother. Yeah, I mean, that's fine as a device. I just didn't like that book. But anyway, you have to have a device, and so I was thinking, but as I say, I write in pieces, so I just skipped how she got there for the time being. And then during my various research, you know, about Scotland, because I'd never been to Scotland when I wrote Outlander, so I did all of that from library research. And so while doing this, I kept coming across mentions of various standing stone circles and monoliths and things like that, which are, of course, fascinating. Everybody finds them fascinating. And every single description would go into the placement of the stones and, you know, what people thought they might be for and so forth. But they would always end up saying, but nobody actually knows what the standing stone's purpose was. And I was thinking, I could imagine one. And so I said, okay, let's try that. So that's where that came from. Yeah, just a chance looking for a place to happen. In other words, I was looking for a mechanism, and it just showed up in the course of the research, as things often do. I find all kinds of things in the research that I would never have thought of looking for, but they turn out to be important, which is why you should do a lot of outside reading if you're writing about something that's factual and, you know, has information about it. If you're doing fantasy, then you're working out of your own experience, basically, and you don't have to do too much embroidery.
Talk about focus in terms of action or fight scenes.
can we talk about focus in terms of action? Yes, actually we can. Action overrides everything, and for the reason that I gave you earlier, which is that we grew up as predator and prey, and we instinctively pay attention to action above everything. You know, if your attention is focused on an interesting show that you're watching, if a fly buzzes across the screen, your eyes are going to follow the fly. Rather than doing images on the screen, you know what's important, or your sub-brain knows what's important. Likewise, if you're sitting in a mall and just watching people walk by, if someone comes running down the mall, you're immediately going to look at that because urgency, is there an emergency? Yeah, this is instinctive, and it's instinctive if you read it in print too. Nobody was doing anything physical in this except the whale, but yeah, certainly your eyes were focused on the whale rising under the ship. So any action will draw the reader's attention. In fact, sometimes you have to be careful how you use it in order not to distract anybody from what's going on. If you want an intense conversation, you know, don't have extraneous interruptions. Just while describing, you know, the waving leaves outside, or you know, birds humming in the trees. Unless you want to have a pregnant pause, in which case the person having the pause is picking up all these sounds. But that's just, you know, pacing rather than focus. Else? Yeah, I'm good in about 5 minutes. All good. Let's see if I have anything short that might be useful or entertaining. This is sort of a traveling scene. Traveling scenes are always good because the story is going in a direction.